We're back, Viv and Yaakov, Sunday morning, doing our best to find glimmers of hope in what really is quite a dark scenario. Things are not good in Israel. The war in Gaza drags on. Hostages remain in captivity. The northern front with Hezbollah is a hot mess. There is always the possibility of everything escalating. People in Israel are despairing, enraged, and hold the civilian government and IDF in very low esteem. We love our army and our soldiers. We love our people. We love our values. But we feel that the government and army no longer represent us. They have betrayed us and continue to do so. This is not discontent over tax rates. This is existential stuff. And it is especially profound as we head into the Passover holiday period, which is one of the happier dates in the Jewish calendar. But not this year. So we talk about why and how we should understand this very unstable time in the arc of history and in the moment. I'm Vivian Berkovich, former Canadian ambassador to Israel, and now living in the awesome and somewhat somber state of Tel Aviv. Stay with us. Good morning, Yaakov Katz. How are you today? On this fine Sunday, Erev Pesach.
Getting ready for the holiday.
And tell me, in your world, in your family, among your friends, what are you saying to people? We customarily say at this time of year, Chag Sameach, Happy Passover, which to me doesn't feel quite right. What are you guys saying? How are you handling that?
You're 100% right that it's hard to say Chag Sameach or happy anything these days. But I think that despite everything, we do have to, you know, I've had people who have said to me, like my mother said to me, they should cancel Passover this year. I said, you know, Mom, it doesn't work that way. But I think we have to find a way to do the best that we can under the circumstances. And it's going to be hard to enjoy this holiday because every time you want to enjoy it, you're going to think about the 133 people who are in some hole somewhere in Gaza, who are far from enjoying it, and all their families who are suffering here. And also all the other families that have an empty chair around their Seder table this year because they've lost somebody in the fights of October 7th or the battles in Gaza after. It's a painful time.
It really is. And I'm going to be posting tomorrow on Monday morning a very short written piece and offering to people so that they consider using this at their Seder table, and so can you. The Forum for Hostage Families has suggested a second empty chair at every Seder table, and they've also written a prayer for a fifth cup of wine in honor of all those people that you just mentioned, and try to acknowledge our despair in some way. Yeah.
So I'll tell you something that I've done is, I mean, the little that I think we at least could do is similar to that. Printed up a bunch of about 10 bios of different hostages, which I feel like, you know, short, not long.
Yeah.
And that just in different sections of the Haggadah to take a break and somebody else will read this story of this hostage because they should be on our mind. We're celebrating some sort of redemption and liberation.
Exactly.
There are people, and you know, and I mean, let's not get too religious on this podcast, but we're told in that Passover that at the Seder, we're supposed to look at ourselves as if we were liberated from Egypt. We were taken out of Egypt. It's important to remember that there's a lot of people who are far from being taken out or liberated at this moment. So, yeah.
Okay. So I'm not, Yaakov is observant, modern Orthodox. I am as hardcore secular Tel Aviv as it gets. So it's not religious, but I can say this, this is a moment. And I think it's a really important moment for us to use and incorporate and recognize into our lives and understand it's a huge, significant moment. When Soviet Jewry was an issue, and I actually went to the Soviet Union to meet with refuseniks in the early 80s. But, you know, that was a time also when we incorporated their lack of freedom into our Passover Seders. You know, it's really important to just keep refreshing our history and not become complacent. We all know about the eye rolls, you know, when it gets to like, oh, yeah, every generation we should actually feel as if we're coming out of Egypt. There's a very profound message for everyone in that. Whether you're secular or religious. Okay, the sermon is concluded. Let's get on to the hard politics now. A week ago, we were breathing a huge sigh of relief. We had just come through the attack
by Iran, in which 350-ish missiles and drones had been aimed at Israel, and 99% had been intercepted. But we didn't know that was going to be the outcome on Saturday night when we were told to go get into our safe rooms and do whatever we do there. And then the question was, are we going to retaliate? Is Israel going to retaliate? Well, we now know the answer to that. And I don't think Israel's officially taken credit, but
no,
a few days ago, there seemed to be seven sites in Iran that were related to the military infrastructure, one near Natanz, which is a known nuclear site, and a number of missiles managed to get through Iranian radar and to hit the targets. So whoever devised that attack was sending a very pointed message: don't mess with us, because we can actually hit you and hit you hard and hit you where it hurts. Do you think that that was the right message to send?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Israel had been attacked in a way that is unprecedented. And it was a direct historic attack by Iran. And I think we have to recognize the fact that while 99% of those projectiles, drones, cruise missiles, ballistic missiles were all intercepted, so a very successful operation last two Saturday nights ago, or two Sundays ago.
It was only 1 week ago. Yeah.
It was only 1 week ago.
Yeah.
Look at me.
Exactly.
I'm like, yeah, yeah, you're right. It was a week ago. It was a week ago Sunday. Exactly.
That's right. Yeah.
Feels like a lifetime.
Right.
It really does.
I know.
It was a week ago Sunday. So when all those projectiles and drones were intercepted very successfully, you know, you could say on the one hand, wow, what a success. And the world tried to tell Israel, take the win. Although it wasn't a win, it was a successful defense. But Israel, I think, did need to respond with force because of two basic reasons. Number one is you have to be very careful of allowing a precedent like this to be set and for Iran to think that they can do this again. And we could set ourselves up for this now to become the quid pro quo for anything that we'll ever do against Iran in the future. But the other point, Vivian, which I think is also very important, is that let's imagine for a moment that we had taken out this General Zahadi in Damascus a year ago, before October 7th, because we've taken out Iranian people in the past.
Right.
And they've never responded like this. They believe today that we are weak. They are trying to create a new balance of power. And that is why even more so, the precedent fine, but even more so, we had to respond in force because we had to teach the Iranians a lesson that there is no new balance of power, guys. The Iranian MO is never to attack from Iran. It's always to use proxies. They never attack from Iran because they don't want to get hit in Iran. They thought that they could do that now because they identified our weakness. And that says something about where Israel is 6 months after October 7th. But it also says something, I hope, about the miscalculation that they made, and hopefully they learned the lesson with our response.
So in other words, what you're saying is that if it was Israel that actually did it, that we hopefully have reestablished deterrence vis-a-vis Iran attacking us directly.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what was done, based on foreign reports, as we like to call them, there was a missile or several missiles that were launched at Iran, took out a key component of the S-300 air defense systems. I've seen the satellite footage. You could see how they were set up. Basically, in the center is where they have a radar system, and then around it are the trucks with the launchers, which the S-300 is a very sophisticated Russian-designed surface-to-air defense system, so meant to intercept incoming aircraft as well as, you know, potential missiles. The ability to take it out, you know, you could take out a building, that's one thing, but to take out the component of the S-300 is basically to say to the Iranians, your system that is supposed to defend you can't even defend itself. We can get you wherever we want, whenever we want, and however we want. And that's an important message to send around.
Okay, so I would suggest that may, you know, distill into deterrence has been reinforced, reestablished.
Yeah.
But okay, that's overly simplistic, but we want to move on to the next topic now, because I got a few things to get through with you today. We had a scoop by Barak Ravid of Axios, formerly of, he's still with Voila, based now in DC. And the scoop that he came out with last night was that the US, I guess the Pentagon, is going to be sanctioning a unit of the IDF called Netzach Yehuda, which is an ultra-Orthodox unit. And the reasons for doing so are that the unit has allegedly misbehaved significantly in operations in the West Bank. Anthony Blinken spoke to this recently, I believe, from some summit in Capri, which is a nice place for a summit. And said, you know, as they do, You will be hearing from us in coming days. And so we heard the sanction has not yet been imposed officially. So tell us about this. What's the significance of it? Why now? And do you think it's actually going to happen, or is it a really sort of stern warning shot?
The Americans, this administration is playing a very complex, strange, and I would even say dangerous game with Israel, right? On the one hand, the same night that they're passing through the House of Representatives, a $13, $14 billion aid package for Israel, right, is the same night that they're leaking to Barak Ravid this story about the sanctions that are going to be imposed for the first time in history against an active standing Israeli military unit. Now, also, let's just think for a moment, what does it exactly mean to sanction a unit? I can understand sanctioning a person, but to sanction a unit, like they won't be able to use Hummer vehicles anymore. They won't be able to use M4s. They won't be able to use American-made bullets that we buy with the foreign military financing. I mean, like, where do you draw the line? And how does a whole battalion of hundreds of people not benefit in a larger military from what we know to be the US aid? Can an F-15 provide Netzach Yehuda with air cover and air support when they're operating in Gaza? Or do they say, no, F-15s now can't? I mean, like, so what are we supposed to use? The Sukhois that we have? I mean, we don't have. Or the MiGs? What is this? This is ridiculous. That's number one. Number two is, why every time that the U.S. decides to help and stand and support Israel, does it also have to stick it to Israel? And that's kind of what we're seeing here. So I think that, you know, there's that message. And then there's the sanctions are extremely, I mean, this is, you know, when they sanctioned the first four or five settlers, we said, no, it's just against settlers. This is against Israelis. Now they're sanctioning a military unit. Next thing you know, they're going to sanction government ministers or Knesset members. Where will this end? And Israel today has no policy of what to do, by the way. We don't know how to operate with sanctions, right? Banks are freezing bank accounts. People are, you know, not willing to have
my God, almost sounds like Canada.
Yeah. I mean, so I think that we're in a bit of trouble here. And it seems to me to have to do more with the U.S. politics than has anything to do with the Israeli politics. And this is about how they want to, yes, support us, because that's what right. They understand to be the right thing. But politically speaking, Biden sees what's going on in Columbia University and in Michigan. And by the way, it's crazy what's going on there.
It is crazy.
Yeah.
So let me, you know, Itamar Ben-Gvir, our Minister of National Security, stepped up immediately. Yep.
Yeah.
Stepped up immediately and said, you know, basically, F the United States, we're going to, if Netzach Yehuda is sanctioned or can't operate appropriately, I'll take the guys into my unit, because he now basically has huge authority to operate his own pretty autonomous, independent, so-called police unit. But I would suggest that it's a paramilitary. So just want to kind of throw that out there so that everyone's reassured that Netzach Yehuda, they may not have air cover, as you point out, but
can I also be a little sarcastic? Join your sarcasm?
Of course.
I mean, you know, to do Netzach Yehuda, just so our listeners know, this is a battalion. It's part of the Kfir Infantry Brigade, but it was basically the first unit. It used to be called Nachal Haredi. It was basically what was established as a new program to get Haredim, ultra-Orthodox, into the IDF service. So the way they do it is three-year military service. They serve for about 2 years on a base in the Jordan Valley, and then they do operations mostly in the West Bank. For the first time, they've operated in Gaza during this war, but they have about 2 years of service, and then they give them the what's known as the Bagrut, the matriculation exams in Israel, so they can get a high school diploma and then basically go to university and get jobs. So it's actually a successful program. It's been around for about 20 years now, maybe not longer. So what I was going to say, just as the sarcasm in me was going to be, you know, at a moment when so many Haredim are serving in the military, right, they're taking away this unit. And that's, of course, a joke, because we're not getting any Haredim in the military. Yeah. Sorry. Whatever.
Yeah. That went over like a lead balloon. But
yeah.
Okay.
Sorry. OK.
That's OK. You can have your moment. You can have your moment. He's still smiling, but also beat red. So that's good. Strategic position of Israel.
Strategic position, yes.
Strategic position. So look, leading up until the Iran attacks, we were just getting hammered. You know, genocide, no aid, you know, everything in the book, get out of the Gaza Strip, and all kinds of talk of diplomatic sanctions and isolation. And then all of a sudden Iran attacks. And so, I mean, I hate to say this, but, you know, silver lining was that the world was like, holy crap, these guys are serious. People love dead Jews, but we see this unprecedented Air Force collaboration, you know, multi-state scramble, including Saudi Arabia and Jordan, to protect Israel and shoot down the missiles and the drones that were targeting us. Since then, I mean, to my ears and mind, the hitch and the hysteria of the level of criticism of Israel has subsided somewhat. Do you agree with that? And if so, do you think it's meaningful?
Yeah, I mean, listen, to come under attack by 350 plus drones, cruise missiles, and ballistic missiles from this violent, oppressive regime in Iran is going to get you a lot of sympathy and solidarity. And we saw this amazing regional collective and an alliance that came together with Jordan and the Saudis and the French and the British and the Americans, of course, everyone working to intercept this. You know, is that something that you can rely on the next time? No. And I think that's why Israel did need to respond. But I really mean that when I say people love dead Jews. They see that we're under attack. They like us. The moment we fight back, and they'll all say, by the way, that the G7 meeting, we support Israel's right to act in self-defense. Yeah, as long as we're getting attacked, you support our right. But the moment we actually attack back, no, then you got to stop. And this is just, it repeats itself over and over again, right? Yeah. They loved us on October 7th and for the first 2 weeks before we went into Gaza. But the moment we went into Gaza, suddenly it's all out the window. In other words, we're only good when we're being attacked or we're being killed. That's a stain, I think, on the world and its level of morality. You know, will it sustain itself? The world is definitely trying to entice us to believe that it will, and it could be. And I think that, and people won't hear this from me often.
Right.
Kudos to Prime Minister Netanyahu for what I think he pulled off, an exceptional, so far, assuming that we're done now with Iran, an exceptional operation here. Because on the one hand, the whole world coming together to fight and defend.
Yeah.
On the other hand, crafting a response despite world opposition that got a message across to the Iranians, but did not break the alliance that has been created. And it seems also, according to reports, getting the sign off on a Rafah operation, which is what he wanted. If this is all really happening, I'd say that's that's impressive diplomatic acrobat. You know, right there.
Yeah, I would say that he likely deferred finally to Gadi Eisenkot and Gallant and Benny Gantz. Not that any one of those three is any brilliant diplomatic planner or strategist, but he was not listening to Ben-Gvir, right? And also note how just as right before I think we heard of that attack on Iran or the counterattack on Iran, and of course Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and that whole side of the Knesset is pushing Bibi to really slam Iran. And what did Bibi do? He comes out and says, I met with Moshe Gafni and Aryeh Deri, two Haredi political leaders. And they told me that the rabbis say that we should not counterattack or attack Iran in any kind of way that's going to result in the Chag.
Yeah.
And Passover being ruined. So that was his cover, right? He could do a limited operation that wouldn't tick off the Americans in the West, that would send the message he needed to send, but then calls in his Haredi, you know, cowboys to support him so that when Ben-Gvir and Smotrich want to attack, he can say, can't do it. Don't want. I mean, that to me was like the icing on the cake.
Listen, I think that Bibi is always hesitant with these things. And we know that, right? He's always a little hesitant with force. I think that what happened, though, in Iran is classic Bibi, right? Standoff operation, far away, sophisticated technology, very pinpoint, very precision guided. That is the Bibi MO. But, you know, he does have to balance and thread a very delicate needle here.
And Yes, he does. Unlike Naftali Bennett, when he was prime minister for a year, Benjamin Netanyahu does understand the importance of paying very close attention to local politics.
A, local politics. B, he doesn't have the same hug and embrace that Bennett enjoyed from the Biden administration. I just want to say one other thing, and I have a lot of criticism of him, and it's all true, but I also think that we have to recognize, listen, Israel today, as much as we can criticize, Israel today is the most attacked country in the world, friends. Keep that in mind. I mean, there's no country that is attacked like us. We have 5 active fronts. It's not normal. And think to be the prime minister of this, and his government is wacky. Don't get me wrong, but this is not simple reality.
No, it is not simple reality. And I will have to add to that that not only does he have to purport to manage this mess, he got us into it. Okay.
He
so,
did. Yes. Yep. I know. Listen, Vivian, he should step down just for the failures
months
of October 7th. You
months
don't have to convince
ago.
Me that. And the entire military leadership, I totally agree. But listen, that's not happening. And the reality is such, and Iran has now directly attacked us, and we do have to retaliate, and we have to keep the Americans somehow, and we still have to prosecute a war in Gaza and take down Hamas. I mean, there's so much
not
going
to mention,
on.
Yeah, not to mention the fact that the North has been absolutely destroyed. Like the towns and the Moshavim and the kibbutzim up there have been totally flattened a la Gaza.
This past Thursday, Uvda people.
I saw it, yeah.
It's like our 60 minutes. Itai Engel did a video. I mean, just what's happened to Metula? It's destroyed, just like you said.
Yep. And Kibbutz Manara.
Are you concerned with what is going on in Israel? This is not just another crisis. State of Tel Aviv is committed to delivering superb and candid analysis. And we're offering a limited time subscription special. A 33% discount from the regular fee of $90 annually. 1 year for only $60. Stay informed and stay connected with State of Tel Aviv. We are a reader-supported enterprise. If you value our work, please subscribe. It makes a huge difference. stateoftelaviv.com. All one word. Now, back to the podcast.
And so for our closing segment, I do want to talk about this kind of, it's felt like for more than 6 months, but now it really feels like we're building in a different way to a moment of uncontainable combustion. And I'll tell you why I say that.
Just your general optimism.
Yeah, I am my sunny disposition. No, I like to call myself, I think of myself as a pragmatic optimist, you know?
I'll sign off on that.
Okay, good. So we have 133 hostages still in captivity. People are starting to say out loud, they're wondering if any are alive, and if so, how few. There's no illusion that there are 100 people alive, which has kind of been the government's line till now. We can confirm 30 are dead, but it might be more. We know that Hamas has rejected the most recent so-called deal on the negotiating table. We know that there's been tension for some time between Qatar and Hamas, and that Hamas is now shopping around for another jurisdiction where they can set up their terror home because they're being pressured too much by Qatar to make a deal.
And Hania was in Turkey yesterday. Yes.
He was
meeting
in
with
Turkey.
Erdogan.
Exactly. And we know that one of the options for him to relocate is Oman. I would think that another might be Kuwait. Perhaps there's a third. Perhaps Turkey's also on the table. Although as a NATO member, I'm not sure that even Erdogan could pull that one off, you know. So we have Hamas is clearly in chaos in terms of any internal management or leadership. Sinwar, in my view, is likely operating rogue. That's just Viv based on no intel or anything, but based on what we're seeing. We have hostage families speaking out and saying what would have been unthinkable things. Old ladies, old women who were released. You may have seen on Channel 13 last night, there were three former hostages from near Oz, women in their 70s. The things that they are saying, and they're not wrong. They're saying we were betrayed. We have been betrayed by our country. We have been betrayed by our army. One of them speaking at Hostage Square a few weeks ago, Adina Moses said, this is not my flag. This is not my country. Like, where am I? Because none of the values that I uphold, adhere to, understood to be meaningful are being honored and respected here. What is going on? And I think that as we go into Pesach, the families of the hostages have demanded, not asked, demanded a meeting with the war cabinet before the Seder. Now, I don't know where that demand sits right now. I expect somewhere in the ether. And if and how the war cabinet will respond to them will be interesting. But I see a level of anger that's not just the hostage families, to my mind, goes to the soul of what this country stands for, which is to be a safe haven and to represent certain values and to move heaven and earth and then some galaxies to bring home anyone, soldier or civilian, who is captured. And here we sit 6 months on. Boy, are we stuck in the mud. All right. So now you're going to either say I'm crazy, I'm so pessimistic, it's unjustified. But what's your take? As always, give us some light, Yaakov.
No, Vivian, there's no light here. I agree with every word you just said. And I was listening intently and I was like, no, I really do. I think that we, you know, I thought about this yesterday over Shabbat. How like the last week since this whole Iranian thing. So I've done a ton of interviews, TV, whatever, radio. I didn't once mention the hostages in the entire week. And I felt terrible. Suddenly it dawned on me yesterday. I didn't mention the hostages because we were just caught up with Iran. It's like we all forgot as a nation almost. It's like
not me, not me.
I know some people didn't, but like we were all Iran, 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 Iran. And there's 133 people languishing. And I personally, I felt terrible yesterday. Suddenly I'm like, you know, how am I not talking about this as I think we all should? It's heartbreaking. It just is. And there's nothing to say. Except we cannot forget them.
And you have children in the army. You send your kids out to fight in this army. God forbid something happens to anyone's children and their additional soldiers taken hostage. Do you have faith?
No.
That our army?
No.
Okay.
But I don't have faith in our army either anymore. And I don't have faith in our leadership anymore. And I don't. And I'm sorry. We're not the Israel that people once thought we were. We're not anymore. And that's change. And we also as a people have to recognize that as change.
So here's where we are going to, because I was at a Shabbat lunch yesterday and it got very, not heated, but very, where people were really intense, you know, because people are angry and afraid. And the overarching question, you know, we sort of, you know, say every week, oh yeah, the government's got to go, but they're not going anywhere. They have to go. And the idea of leadership has to go. So yeah. We are on Erev Pesach. We're all going to be talking about this at Seder tables that we attend. And we're all going to be talking about this throughout the holiday period.
We will.
What the hell do we do? What do we do other than sit here, you know, a bunch of lemels, you know, lemons in Yiddish, but a lemel was like a real, it's yeah. Like a smartut. It's like a schmata. What do we do other than sit around like a bunch of lemels and say, oh, they're not going. This country has to save itself.
We do have to save ourselves. We need reset. We need a renewal on so many levels. But we'd have to get there. We have to get our people home. This is really, it's outrageous that these people have been there for over 6 months, that they'll be spending Passover while we'll be sitting around drinking our four cups, having a good roast beef, a brisket. They will not. And
those who are alive.
Those who are alive. And as a holiday that is supposed to be about the liberation, we have the ability to liberate our people. If we have that ability, we have to seize it and take it now. And that should trump everything at the moment. Everything.
Amen. Best wishes to you and your family.
Chag Sameach as much as is possible.
I'm going to say have a meaningful holiday. And we'll come back raring to go next Sunday. Is it a Yontif next Sunday?
I think Sunday night.
Okay, so we can do our shtick on Sunday.
We could do our shtick Sunday.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Yaakov, as always.
Thank you, Vivian.
Enjoy the brisket.
Thanks for listening, as always, and for your support. For our listeners who will be marking Passover, best wishes for a meaningful holiday. It could be worse, but then again, it could be better. Let's hope that next year it will be. I close with a message from the Hostage Family Forum, which I will also include in a short written dispatch that I will publish on Monday morning, Eastern Time. It will include this prayer that the hostage families ask that you consider saying at your own Seder table, at any table, in fact. If it's at a Seder table, add a fifth glass of wine and an extra chair and say these words. May it be God's will that all expressions of salvation be realized for each captive. I will bring you out. I will redeem you. I will take you as my own. I will bring you home. May they all merit to return to their families, those murdered to be buried, and those still alive to be rehabilitated in our time. Amen. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the State of Tel Aviv and Beyond podcast. We'll keep the dispatches coming as frequently as we can. If you like what you're hearing, please take a moment, rate us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. You can check out our full library of articles and podcasts at our website, stateoftelaviv.com. State of Tel Aviv is an independent media venture, and we rely on subscribers to support our work. If you are not yet a paying subscriber, please consider taking the plunge today. Each person really does make a huge difference, especially in these very challenging times in Israel. It is important that you stay informed and current and seek out a range of perspectives. This is a pivotal moment in Israeli history. It is not a time to be passive and disengaged. Thanks for sticking with me to the end. I'm Vivian Berkovich, signing off from deep inside the state of Tel Aviv.